Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton. Thursday is the deadline for Sacramento's year-long effort to keep the Kings in Sacramento, which means coming up with a plausible plan to build an arena. This weekend, Mayor Kevin Johnson, the Maloof brothers, and the NBA spent many hours in Orlando in closed-door discussions, and Sacramento Bee reporter Ryan Lillis was there hanging around waiting for some word. And Ryan, what have you heard?
What we've heard is that the talks are still going. I'm in the lobby at the Waldorf Astoria here in Orlando. The mayor, other top city officials, the Maloof family, and the NBA, including the commissioner, David Stern, have been meeting since about 9 o'clock Eastern time this morning. They have not emerged yet, and depending on who you hear from, it could be any minute, could be a couple of hours, but so far, no news yet.
Okay, yeah, and we saw them with them coming out of the hearings or the meetings last night. They all looked pretty tired and not particularly peppy, with maybe the exception of the mayor.
Yeah, well, yesterday ended up being a little bit different day than people had thought. The city went into yesterday thinking that was going to be the day they sat down with the Maloofs and hammered out a deal. As it turns out, most of the day yesterday was the NBA meeting privately with the Maloof family, going over the terms that the city and the NBA have worked out. So up until this weekend, the National Basketball Association has been doing the talking for the Maloofs with the city. So it wasn't until just the last day or two that the Maloofs kind of came to the table and had firsthand knowledge of what was being asked of them.
Oh, well, that's good. But why wasn't the city involved in those meetings?
Yeah, I think it was a matter of the NBA. First of all, has a very strong relationship with the Maloofs, and I think they were just presenting what was being asked of them. Perhaps there were discussions of how the NBA could help facilitate what is being asked of the Maloofs. We've had sources tell the Bee that the city has asked the Maloofs to contribute between $70 and $90 million up front toward the arena project, most of that in upfront lease payments. And the NBA thinks that that's a fair deal. The question has been whether it's a deal the Maloofs can afford at this time.
Right. They've been through some fairly tight financial times the last few years. How many days is this going to go on? Is today the last day? I know we've got Thursday as the deadline, but these deadlines have been somewhat fungible.
Yeah, they're sticking hard to the Thursday deadline for sure. At least they had been going into the talks this morning. We're getting the sense that they're not going to finish today, that they'll probably, the sides will all leave Orlando either tonight or first thing tomorrow morning. So this will likely be the last time all of the sides sit down face to face. But, over the next couple of days, you might have the Maloof family go back and huddle in Las Vegas or Sacramento and discuss the deal. You're going to have city officials here go back. John Shirey, the city manager, has already left to fly back to catch a flight for Sacramento. There's nothing to look into there. He has other jobs he has to attend to, including going back and briefing the city council on these talks. So that'll be taking place over the next couple of days. And I suspect that they have a deadline, and they're probably going to work right up until that deadline on Thursday.
Sounds like from that even after you get some word today, we're still not really going to know anything. We're going to just know a little bit more of the parameters of what the deal might be, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably close. I mean, the mayor came into the weekend saying he wanted to make a lot of progress and get to a point where they could leave Orlando needing only to dot the I's and cross the T's. Mm-hmm. Now, the city feels that they've done their part. They've presented a solid plan, according to them, and that there's nothing much really more that the city is going to do. So, that's obviously an attempt to put more pressure on the Maloofs and to pressure the Maloofs into, agreeing to what's being asked of them in this negotiation.
Speaking with Ryan Lills of the Sacramento Bee about the negotiations in Orlando for the Kings and for the arena in Sacramento. Ryan, going forward, after we hit Thursday and there is some kind of a deal announced, let's be optimistic and say that the Maloofs have agreed to a certain amount and the NBA is going to pitch in. What is the brief, or maybe not brief, but briefly, what is the process going forward from March 1st?
So the process is that the term sheet would be released on Thursday if there is a term sheet. The public would have four or five days to look at it. The city council would have four or five days to look at it. And then that sets up a vote a week from tomorrow on March 6th with the Sacramento City Council, in which they decide yes or no to agree to the term sheet. And they have to vote on the term sheet because, as we all know, it involves a great deal of public assets. Right. The spine of this project is the $200 million that the city is counting on through leasing downtown parking to a private vendor. So the council needs to approve that. There's also a discussion of selling some city-owned land to help do this. And then in the last day or two, sources tell me that the discussion has gone toward helping the Maloofs refinance the loan that the Sacramento Kings franchise has with the city. It's a loan that dates back to the prior ownership of the franchise, but refinancing that loan would help ease some future burdens for the Maloof family. It's also seen as kind of a negotiating ploy to entice them to contribute more upfront to the project.
All right. Well, Ryan Lillis, Sacramento Bee, thanks for checking in with us and keeping us up to date on what's going on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
In case you haven't noticed, this week is yet another one of those theme weeks that dot the calendar. It's Beer Week, and it runs from last Friday through this Thursday at various venues around town. But for a lot of people, every week is Beer Week. What makes this one so special? That's what my guests are here to explain. They are Scott Kramlett, who is the brewmaster at Rubicon, has been for a long time, almost all of the 25 years that Rubicon has been around. J.E. Pano is the proprietor at Roostaller, Sacramento-style beer, and Jay Prahl is beer maker at Sudwerk Restaurant and Brewery, who does German-style beer, and they are all here in the studio. Welcome, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What makes, why is this Beer Week? How did Beer Week develop?
Beer Week developed a few years ago. Well, actually, a lot of cities around the United States have started doing Beer Weeks to celebrate the art and craft of brewing. For a lot of us, 52 weeks out of the year is Beer Week,
right?
Like you mentioned. But we live, eat, drink, sleep, making beer and enjoying beer.
But you live in a fantasy land that few mortals can comprehend.
We've been told that, yes.
Yes. And did Beer Week just start happening here in Sacramento recently? Because I wasn't really aware of it in the last few years.
This is the third year, and I think the
J.E.?
Yeah, J.E. Not really sure why we picked February, but I think it was probably threw a calendar up, threw a dart at it, and said that sounds good. So, but it's worked great, and it's grown every year, and it's been great for restaurants and breweries, and I think all the local fans as well.
And what are the parameters of Beer Week in the sense that do places have sort of deals on beer, or do they have what are people doing around town, and who's involved?
Well, I think that's the great part is that, and why it's so grown so organically and so quickly is there is very few rules. It's kind of everyone can be creative, both on the brewery side as well as the restaurant side and the bar sides, and just come up with something that's fun that fans are going to love, and it's really all about Sacramento and all about great beer.
And we're talking about Sacramento Beer Week. We actually have a bunch of bottles. This is the earliest I've seen this many bottles lined up somewhere. In the morning, and we're going to have some beer tasting here. I've never done beer tasting on the air, so we'll sort of see how this goes, but we'll try to be very descriptive for everybody. Why don't you guys actually start pouring some of these out, because they're all still in bottles, and we have bottle openers and everything. And Scott from Rubicon, I think you guys are probably the oldest continually running brewery in town, is that correct?
At this point, that's correct.
And you started in the 25 years ago, so started in the 80s. What was the beer scene in Sacramento like when Rubicon started?
It was pretty sparse at the time. There was another brewery that had opened up before us, and that was Hogshead Brewery. They opened up in July of 1986, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
We opened up in November 1st, 1987. And quite honestly, it was the early, not as pioneering as when Roostaller's first opened, but it was the first generation of this craft beer movement. Sierra Nevada had just opened in 1982,
mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And so There you go, Jay.
I like that. We get a little beer pouring sound on the radio.
And so we were part of the first wave of what's now known as the craft beer movement.
Okay.
Back in 87.
Yeah, because as I recall in the 80s, it was pretty much Budweiser, real light lagers and... let's put it this way: it wasn't so interesting.
There wasn't as much diversity as we have now. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing world of beer out there.
And was that just an awareness that you and the founders of Rubicon had that there was a lot of beer out there that wasn't being made and that people didn't know about?
Well, a reawakening, a renaissance. The original owner of Rubicon, Ed Brown, had gone to England and tasted some of the really great ales over there, and was inspired to come back and be part of this new fledgling movement. The light lagers are fantastic. We have a lot of great friends that work for Budweiser and really respect those beers, but sometimes diversity is nice.
Mm-hmm.
And we really had to, there wasn't a lot of drinkers out there for these styles. And so the industry kind of grew along with the consumers. We were throwing new creative beers out there, resurrecting old styles. And luckily, there were a lot of folks that came along for the journey with us. And mm-hmm. here we are today with lots of breweries, lots of styles, and a very exciting, dynamic thing called craft brewing.
We're talking about beer, and it's Beer Week in Sacramento, and it goes through this Thursday, right? Am I correct?
No. All the way through Sunday.
All the way through Sunday. Okay.
This is a long, a week to a brewer.
This is a drinker's
11
week.
Days.
So,
yeah.
Okay. Got it.
A short week for us is 9 days.
Yeah. Okay. and Jay Prawl from Sidwork, you guys started in what year?
1989, 1990. Okay. We were brewing in 89, but we didn't open the doors until 1990. And making lager beers requires some aging time, so we got a head start before we opened the doors.
Okay. Yeah. And you're in Davis, right?
Correct.
And you distribute all over the West Coast, it sounds like.
All of California, Oregon, Nevada, Arizona, some other states further east. We send some beer to Guam, of all places, as well. So okay. Send some to the UK.
Beer does. Guam
well.
Doesn't need beer anywhere less than anywhere else. Well, let's let's try a couple of beers. This is let's see, it's 10:20 in the morning. All right. So
that's Rustaller 1881, our California red ale. It's named for the year Rustaller was founded when he brewed his first beer, and so that was his first year, our first brew. And it's a California red ale because 95% of the malted barley comes from California. So that's.
That's good, and it's not super hoppy, but you can definitely taste the hops in
there. Yeah, it goes really well with food. This is what's at Mulvaney's and Magpie and 1022 and Roxy and restaurants like that. So the chefs really like it because it pairs well with food, doesn't dominate, but complements.
And we should also say, anybody who drives down J Street in Sacramento sees a building, I think, at 9th and J?
9th and J,
where the Christian Science Reading Room is downstairs, and up above is the Rustaller building, right?
Well, the whole building's the Rustaller building.
Okay.
But yeah, that was his headquarters back when he was running his business, and it was a tap room in the basement, offices on the first and second floor, or what's now the first and second floor. Of course, you know, the streets were raised at some
right.
point. So, and then the third and fourth floor actually was the entertaining room for the Rustaller family. I was told that by Charlotte Gilmore, who's a local Rustaller, mm-hmm. that the Rustallers did all their entertaining in that building, not in their home. So it has a lot of history.
And we should say the Rustallers, you said 1881, that was when Rustaller originally started. Was Rustaller a German?
He's Swiss German.
Swiss German, okay.
Central Switzerland.
And how long did Rustaller operate and then close down, and then what's the story behind you guys reopening?
Yeah, he operated until 1929, 28, when... the government took the best thing Sacramento had going and killed it, prohibition.
Right.
And pretty much that drove a lot of the brewers in Sacramento, not just Rustaller, into other businesses. And so they got into real estate and farming and other ventures. And it really wasn't until the laws changed in the 70s when we could start, craft brews really could start again that... Mm-hmm. That this became possible.
And when did you restart Rustaller as a brand?
Yeah, I've been working on this since I was a student at UC Davis, so about 2.5 years ago,
okay.
when I read Ed Carroll's book and discovered that we were the beer capital of the West Coast at one point, and I thought, well, let's see if we can re-earn that moniker.
What am I drinking right here? This is
Sudwerk Pilsner.
Okay, and Jay, tell us a little bit about this.
Well, Pilsner's named for a town in the Czech Republic called Pilsen. and it was the place that yellow beer was first invented, and that is a style of beer that's come to dominate the world. There are lots of different kinds of Pilsner. This is a southern German style of Pilsner. It's made with 100% barley malt, usually a Pilsen malt, which gives a light but crisp flavor. And it's for a Bavarian beer, aggressively hopped, about 35 IBUs.
And you mentioned that this is the kind of beer that's become popular all over the world. Is that because it's light? I mean, if you go to, like, you have Singha in Thailand, you have Asahi in Japan, they're all essentially kind of the same kind of beer, right?
Yeah. You know, up until the 1840s, folks drank out of ceramic glassware rather than crystal glassware. And once you could see what was in your glass, the color of a beer became very important. And some maltsters got very creative in coming up with a way to roast their grain without giving too much color. That also gave a nice crisp flavor. And both the appearance and the flavor sort of took the world by storm. And now when folks think of beer, except for this new renaissance here in the U.S., where beer is probably the most interesting place, or this is the most interesting place to drink beer now, this was a kind of beer that really took the world.
We're talking about beer and Beer Week. You guys aren't drinking.
Sorry about that.
I can't drink
alone in the morning. It's just wrong on a couple of different levels. And this is so that's the light. And then this one right here is somewhat less light.
It's a little more golden colored. That is Sudwerk Lager. And Sudwerk, the full name is Sudwerk Privat Brauerei Hoopsch. And our mission statement would be to make authentic Bavarian style lagers.
So that tastes even lighter to me than the Pilsner.
It is a little rounder and a little less hoppy. So the crispness is a little bit less, and it tends to pair well with more foods.
And some of Scott's beers, which I'm most familiar with at Rubicon, tend to be pretty hoppy, and we're going to get to those in just a second. But the difference between these two lagers, the Pilsner is a little bit hoppier, and the lager is, what's the dominant taste then in the lager?
It's very malt forward. That's the way brewers describe a beer that's got a big malty character. And it's got some caramel malt and some Munich malt. Germans refer to beer as liquid bread. It's part of their diet. And that is the house beer throughout Bavaria.
Okay, I'm going to move over here to the darker ones because I like dark beers. And what's this? Is this yours, Scott?
That's our Irish Red Ale from the Rubicon Brewing Company. And it's a beer we've been making for about 20-some-odd years now. And it's currently our winter, early spring release. We bring it out a little bit before Christmas. And
what gives it the red? Because it really is quite, it is a red look.
What makes it the reddish color are very dark roasted, what are called crystal or caramel malts. Mm-hmm. And they give it that rich toffee kind of characteristic. There might be a little smokiness in there, maybe a little raisin character. It's a not your classic red, Irish beer, which they don't tend to be as hoppy or as big as this. But this is Rubicon-style Irish red ale with our classic bigger flavors, more hops, more hop aroma.
And that's how you would describe Rubicon flavors would be bolder, hoppier.
In general, we make beers that run the gamut. We make some very light beers. In the summertime, we'll make a beer called Solamente, and that's like a Mexican-style lager. Very light, very refreshing for those 100-degree Sacramento days. And we also make beers that go all the way up to 11.5% what we call our wheat wine, a very strong, heavy, extremely malty beer. And we make everything in between.
Scott Kramlett, do you guys find, and all of you guys, do you find that people drink darker, heavier beers in the winter and lighter beers in the summer, or do people have just sort of a general tendency to drink lighter beers or darker beers?
I think that's a common misconception that darker beers are for wintertime. We have folks that drink our Irish Stout year-round, and it's their go-to beer. Mm-hmm. And it's personal preference.
What's this?
That's our India Pale Ale,
that's delicious.
And that's our flagship beer. We started making that in 1988, and that is a very hoppy beer with a fair amount of bitterness to it. It's over half of our production, and it's what we call old school.
And that's the IPA?
Yes, sir. Okay. Old school IPA, meaning that it's almost the same way we were making it back in 1988. And back then, people thought that was an extreme beer. It's so bitter. It's so hoppy. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, with all these new brewers coming in, they're making more and more bitter beers, hoppier and hoppier. I call it a hops arm race.
And it has a real sort of a grapefruity, citrusy flavor to me, the real hoppy beers.
Yeah,
do.
What you're picking up is some of the hop characteristics.
Okay.
And there's some of the citrus character. We use Cascades and a variety called Chinooks. And a grapefruity character is one of the signature aromas that you might get from Chinooks.
Going back to Rudstaller, that reminded me when you said hops, it reminded me there used to be hop fields all down around at the end of Watt Avenue at Folsom Boulevard.
Yeah.
I saved the best for last because I'm a dark beer drinker. What am I drinking right here, J.E.?
That's the Captain. It's our black California Black IPA. And
Because it doesn't taste like a stout.
No. So it's malty but not heavy. And it's hoppy but not bitter. So the hop in that is primarily aroma hops. Hops can either impart bitterness or aroma to a beer, and so
you
tried to balance it out well. There.
That was the first thing I did when I drank it. Immediately my nose wanted to go and smell it. It's really good. All right, well, it is Beer Week, and Scott Kramlett, J.E. Pino, and Jay Prawl are all from local brewers, and thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Absolutely. Great. Thanks for
having
us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Inside on Capital Public Radio. We'll be right back.
On the web at capradio.org or by phone at 1-800-800-5867. Make your contribution to Insights and all the people from your neighborhood that you get to meet, all the local stories, all the in-depth conversation. 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org.
Insight is such a unique program, and you know that. That's why you listen to it every single day. And today is a really good example of how eclectic the show is. We got an update on probably the biggest news story in the region right now, which is the talks that are happening for a new arena here in Sacramento. And then it's Beer Week, and I think it's safe to say that that's probably the most extensive coverage of Beer Week anybody is going to do, including the taste testing, which is very important. Those are the kinds of things that you get from Insight. It's a show that runs the gamut from hard news to entertainment, musicians. All sorts of people from our region come on Insight every day. It's an important show and one that is worth your support right now at 1-800-800-5867 or go online to capradio.org.
And now you don't have to be tethered to just your radio or stuck inside your car to take Insight with you, or Capital Public Radio for that matter. If you donate $1 a day to the programs that you use on Capital Public Radio, we'll send you the iPod Nano Touch. For just $1 a day, it has 8 gigabytes worth of space. There's a radio tuner on there as well, so if you're tired of listening to your home music collection, you can always pop on at Capital Public Radio, listen to Insight, listen to Talk of the Nation as well. Really, it's very tiny. It's the size of a quarter of a Post-it note. You can clip it to your bag, clip it to your shirts, and take all your favorite public radio offerings with you. That's yours for $1 a day when you call us up at 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org. Additionally, we get support from Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshots, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. More information is at progressive.com. And from Sacramento Works, a workforce resource for businesses looking for employees and people looking for jobs, Sacramento Works can help. Information at sacramentoworks.org. And from Rudolf Steiner College, offering Waldorf teacher education programs to develop teacher creativity and love of learning in children. Information evenings tonight and March 12th at 7:30, steinercollege.edu.
And if you make your contribution during this fund drive, we will enter your name into a grand prize drawing. It's a trip for two to Italy, 10 days and 11 nights. And on top of that, accompanying you will be Donna Appadoni and Gary Vercelli. It's an exciting trip, and we will enter you into this drawing with your contribution at 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. And now it's time to find out what's in the news today with Alan Ray, our senior editor. And it sounds like we have some news from our first segment. Alan, what's up?
Well, indeed we do. We get the word on Twitter right now from Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson on Twitter announcing there has been a deal for an arena.
Well, if it's on Twitter, it must be true, right?
Well, that's what we all presume, yes. You want to buy a bridge?
So what's the deal?
Well, we don't know any of the details right now. At least I don't. We just got the word, and we'll get some more details and have them for you this afternoon on All Things Considered. A new weather system on the way from Alaska should arrive tomorrow and stay through Wednesday. Figure a half inch of rain in the Sacramento Valley and into the Bay Area. Look for 20 inches of snow in the Sierra above 5,000 feet, 5 to 10 inches at lower elevations. As we say, more news on those stories and others beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
Wow, thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
That's an awful lot of good news in one day.
I just got here.
Yeah, really. Happy Monday.
You too.
There are many trails that run through the Sierra Nevada, including all the way down its north-south spine. But no trail yet exists from the High Sierra across the state to the ocean. But that will change if my next guests have anything to say in the matter. They are Stephen Hine and Kristen Hine-Strom. And as the Mendocino Tahoe Conservancy, they are working to create a trail that will cross the Golden State and will go right from Tahoe to the through our area and to the ocean. And they are here in the studio to discuss it. Welcome.
Thank you.
Why have a trail across the state?
There is a phenomenal diversity of beautiful habitats and cultures that we have in our state, from the coastal species to the redwoods to the vernal pools in the valley and all of the agriculture to the chaparral and the oak woodlands, the alpine areas near Lake Tahoe. It's just phenomenal. So being able to experience all of that diversity in a short period of time mm-hmm. and a short distance is delightful.
And what would be the end, the beginning and the end of this trail?
The Steven? Beginning would be at Jug Handle State Reserve, Jug Handle Park in Casper, north of Mendocino, and it would end at Lake Tahoe, Tahoe City as we see it now. This is carrying on the work of John Olmsted, who was our mentor, who passed away mm-hmm. last March, mm-hmm. and asked me to be his executor, and apart from dealing with all his collection of washing machines and phonographs, I just see he had a spiritual legacy that he left us and a brilliant idea, which is this linked chain of natural sites and the trail across the state, and I'm doing my best to make that happen.
Well, leaving aside the interest in somebody who collects washing machines, what was his vision? He was talking about this was a trail that originally John Muir hiked? Or not a trail, but a...
John Muir got off the train in San Francisco and asked to be shown the nearest wild. And he walked from Oakland to Yosemite. In 1974, John Olmsted received a $1,000 grant to recreate John Muir's trail. At that time, he examined the route and discovered that it went through San Jose, it went past gas cheapers and pavement and parking lots and freeways, and realized that it would be difficult to find the wild, find the beauty, find the nature that Muir had found, mm-hmm. and looked further north in the state and eventually settled on the Highway 20 corridor, the 39th parallel, which right. has large open space still available. The Muir route has since been hiked by Donna and Peter Thomas, I believe their names are, and they've written a lovely book about the trail, but it includes scrambling over the 9-foot freeway fences and mm-hmm. going through the parking lots of the hotels, and it has detailed instructions if you want to follow his route. The route we're looking for does contain more opportunity to experience nature and open space as Muir may or may not have found it.
It includes the Mendocino National Forest, the Cache Creek Wilderness Area, the Barry S. Snow Mountain Area, much of the Tahoe National Forest. There are wildlife refuges in the valley. There's so much truly beautiful wildland that is accessible by just moving a little bit further north for the route.
Now, we said that starting in Casper, which is in Mendocino County north of Jenner?
North of the town of Mendocino, south of Fort Bragg, about 5 miles south of Fort Bragg.
Okay, so quite far north, really. Going from Tahoe straight west, is that where you hit, basically, is sort of that area?
Yes.
Which doesn't compute. Usually you think of that area as being much further north, but it actually cuts right across. So if you went from Casper, and then where's the ending at Tahoe?
In Tahoe City. Which is in the north area
okay.
of the lake.
Just trying to picture this. So if you started at Casper, you're going north of Lake Berryessa.
You are north of Lake Berryessa.
Mm-hmm. And then you're going north of Sacramento. You're going sort of across at Williams.
There's
and
a bridge at
Yuba City.
The next north bridge would be Gridley. The trail as we envision it and as we've walked it is across the bridge at Yuba City. The valley was still problematic in terms of the exact route because there's so much private land there.
Property,
we're trying to cooperate with local groups, landowners, and individuals to develop that part of the route.
We're talking about a route from Mendocino to Tahoe that would cross the state for the first time. And my guests are involved in doing that with the Mendocino Tahoe Conservancy. They are Stephen Hine and Kristen Hine-Strom. Where are you in the process of making this happen? How far along? How conceptual is this, and how much is it possible to actually get across the state in this way?
Well, right now, the eastern third of the trail is entirely hikeable on public lands and on existing trails. There are two sections between Nevada City and Tahoe City that are just a couple hundred feet that aren't on existing trail, and you can easily get around those two small spots, and the rest of it is already there. So we are collaborating with the Tahoe National Forest right now to participate in their Adopt-a-Trail program, and we're also seeking grant funding to publish more information on this route, on which of the existing trails need to be connected, and exactly how to follow that route. People that are interested in walking that route and stitching together these existing trails can contact us through our website, which is mendotahoe.org, M-E-N-D-O-T-A-H-O-E.org.
And we'll have a link to that on our website as well.
Awesome. And you can actually get the map of the route that we hiked from Nevada City to Tahoe City last summer. So that section is totally doable. In the western third, we also have a lot of wonderful contacts, folks who are working on creating new trails and stitching together existing trails throughout Mendocino and Lake counties. So that's a little bit further along in terms of our timeline, but that is also something that's very, very feasible. And then the valley is going to be our third section that's going to take a longer term vision to make happen.
Now, I'm told that you, while you've been hiking the trail, you've been passing the time by singing songs and perhaps even writing songs, and that you recorded a little bit for us to listen to. Let's listen to that.
Oh, the Doolittle Trail is hard to find. It runs through the rocks and the oaks and the pines. And it hasn't been used in many a year, except by the coyotes, the bear, and the deer. And if you're not strong and brave of heart, you might not want to even start. On the Doolittle, 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 Doolittle Trail. So gather your gear and your grub and your griddle and your boots and your pack and your hat and your fiddle. Tie them all together around your middle and head on up the Doolittle, 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 Doolittle Trail.
That's my guests, Stephen Hine and Kristen Hine-Strom. Singing a little trail song there. What is the Doolittle Trail?
The Doolittle Trail is a existing trail that is north of the little town of Washington, and that actually will take you from down next to the Yuba River and then up 2,000 feet in a mile and a half. So it's very steep and very beautiful, and that brings you up to the top of the canyon so that you can look down over an incredible, beautiful area.
And which canyon? Where is this?
This is over the Yuba River Canyon.
Okay, so east of Nevada City.
Yes.
Okay. And what's your, I guess John Olmsted bought some parcels of land along this route as well. So there's, you're really connecting a lot of dots on this, aren't you, Stephen?
John founded the California Institute of Man and Nature, which was a nonprofit in 1969, and has been instrumental in the purchase of numerous parcels, and then in revolving ownership, turn them over to state parks or public lands for access to the public. He had a vision of unchaining private lands and returning them to the public domain so that you and I and the rest of the citizens of the state would have access to these beautiful open space areas. Mm-hmm. He purchased the original Jug Handle site, farm site, which is now the state park. He's instrumental in the purchase of the North Butte, the South Yuba State Park, and two pieces that we still retain, which are an 80-acre piece in Yuba County and a small 3-acre piece near Fort Bragg.
And part of what you're trying to do is raise some money to help continue to pay for these parcels, correct?
Yes, each of these areas has property taxes that are due, and so we are wanting to raise funds to keep them protected for the wildlife that live there and also keep them accessible to the public. Right. Also, we're looking to raise funds to create the various trail segments that are still yet to be created and to continue maintaining the existing trails. This Friday, March 2nd, we're going to have a birthday bash. It's John Olmsted's memorial birthday. It's going to be a fabulous concert that's a benefit for our organization. We're going to have a funky dance band, Power of 12, with a really fabulous horn section. There's going to be jugglers and poets. Lou Casey Vineyards is donating wine. We're going to have wonderful songs from the trail. We'll have soup from local caterer Margot Meredith. It's going to be a really good time. And tickets for that can also be found on our website, mendotahoe.org.
All right. And again, we will have a link to that at capradio.org/insight. Stephen Hine and Kristen Heinstrom, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the trail.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, handmade bicycles. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Insights on listener-supported Capital Public Radio, online at capradio.org. Give us a call at 1-800-800-5867 to support the daily discussions on Capital Public Radio, this uniquely local program. 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org.
Well, almost any news source will give you the who, what, when, and where, but here at Capital Public Radio, we pride ourselves on the why. It's all well and good to know what happened, but until you can put it in some context, understand the meaning, it's just not complete. Capital Public Radio brings you the most complete news coverage you're likely to find anywhere, and it's made possible by listener support. So today is the who is you, and the when is now, and the why, well, it's because this programming is important to you. So make a contribution at 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org.
Eight more contributions to go this hour to keep us on track for this fund drive. Don't forget that you have the power to end the on-air fundraising early. Just by chipping in with your donation, this fund drive can be over when you say it is. We keep you apprised of hourly goals and daily goals and that sort of thing. Let us know with your contribution that you want this fund drive to be done. Give us a call, 1-800-800-5867, and when we get enough contributions, we'll end it happily. We get support from Drexel University's Sacramento Center for Graduate Studies. Details about graduate programs will be explained at an information session on Saturday, March 3rd at 10 a.m. Information at drexel.edu/Sacramento. From CGI, providing built-for-government IT solutions to California for more than 25 years. Experience the commitments at cgi.com/California. And from the James Irvine Foundation, dedicated to expanding opportunity for the people of California to participate in a vibrant, successful, and inclusive society. Information at irvine.org.
So it's a very simple call. It'll take you just a few moments of your time. You can talk to one of the great volunteers that we have here and ask about the Evergreen program to have your payment split up over the course of a year and deducted automatically from your account. It's very easy and it's green. So ask about that when you make your contribution at 1-800-800-5867, or you can go online, contribute safely and securely at capradio.org.
Whether it's t-shirts, coffee mugs, we know those are just sort of little added incentives. What you're contributing for is the quality, thoughtful news coverage, the stories and interviews from newsmakers who are in the Central Valley and around Northern California and Western Nevada. Let's hear from you now. Make support that kind of programming today on Capital Public Radio. 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org. And thanks.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Most bicycles are made in factories by machines, but many are still made by hand, including in this country, even in this city. This weekend, about 100 bicycle makers will be gathering in Sacramento to celebrate the handmade bike. They will also be celebrating the work of one of my guests who's been making bikes by hand for 25 years. His name is Steve Rex, and his Rex Cycles is well known and loved among aficionados of the bicycle. Steve, welcome to Insight.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And also with us is Rick Houston, a bicycle enthusiast who started the Tweed Ride in 2009 and is one of the movers and shakers behind the Handmade Bike Festival. Welcome.
Hi, thanks, David.
What is the appeal to a cyclist of a handmade bike?
Well, what I do is make a bike for a rider just like a tailor makes a suit. It's custom made to measure. It suits their body and it suits their cycling needs, and it's made locally.
Mm-hmm. And is it appreciably more expensive to get a homemade frame or a handmade frame?
it is much more expensive than going to Walmart and buying a bike, mm-hmm. but it is in the same range as any off-the-peg bike that you'd find in other bike shops.
Mm-hmm.
But the hitch is it does take longer to get the bike.
Right. How long does it take you to make a bike?
For me, it's typically 3 to 5 months delivery time.
Really?
Yeah.
Of course, you're working on other bikes at the same
exactly.
time. That's not 3 to 5 months making
to
one bike. That does
bike,
not sound
no.
like a good margin.
No.
Okay.
No. There are people with orders that I have to work through first.
Uh-huh.
So.
And do you make always for individuals, or do you build for companies? Do you build for groups?
No, it's always for an individual. They're all made to measure for someone. In the 90s, I sold through other shops throughout Northern California, quite a few in the Bay Area, but now it's just all customer direct.
And what are obviously the size of the person's body is pretty crucial in the whole thing. But do you make the sizes of the bike the dimensions of the bike radically different, or do you just make it bigger or smaller?
No, everyone has different needs. There can be a small person that needs to sit further back relative to the pedals, or a tall person that needs to sit further forward, which both of those things are opposite of what a typical stock bike might be.
Mm-hmm.
I've made bikes for people ranging in size from about 4.5 feet up to 7 feet tall. So, and we can do that for anyone, make them comfortable on a bike.
And do you find that customers know what they want when they come in? When they get to you and they've already probably bought a couple of off-the-peg bikes before, and now they're looking for something a little bit different, a little bit more special, a little bit more them, right?
Sometimes. That's the case more often than not. But there are people who are enthusiastic that just want to go straight to the best, and there are people with physical needs that preclude them from getting a stock bike.
Enthusiastic is really probably an understatement when it comes to bicycle enthusiasts, and this town is a very big bike town, as witness Rick's event, the Tweed Ride, which happens twice a year in June and November. Rick, what's your involvement with the Handmade Bike Festival?
Well, I guess responsible for bringing it here. I contacted Don Walker, who's the owner of the show, in January of 2010, and begged him to come here. It's a movable show, and it's in different parts of the country, different years. Like last year, it was in Austin. The year before that, in Richmond. The year before that, in Indianapolis. And the year before that, it was in Portland, Oregon, which was the last time it was here on the West Coast.
Mm.
I'd sort of rationalized that it had to come back to the West Coast at some time. And so I called Don and had a great conversation with him and tried to tout Sacramento again as being a wonderful bicycling city, and mm-hmm. how the show could be a wonderful catalyst for, you know, continuing for us to be that way and exposing more people from around the country to what we have to offer here.
And it's an interesting list of cities, because those are all capital cities,
mm-hmm.
and they're all
mm-hmm.
sort of second-tier cities that would be sort of like Sacramento, Richmond, Indianapolis, certainly, Austin,
mm-hmm.
definitely.
Yeah, I see a trend there, too.
Yeah, right? So what's the why is that, as opposed to, you know, the conventions, Jacob Javits in New York and the Staples Center in L.A.?
I would imagine just accessibility to a bicycling culture. Some of the larger cities, even though they have a large number of cyclists there. I think with the smaller capital cities, or second tier as you would call them, what they have to offer is just a wide variety of people of being able to use a bicycling infrastructure in a way that helps them to be exposed to more cycling, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's any particular trend by Don to say that I'm just going to pick out the second tier capital cities. I think it's just basically where he'd like to go that makes more sense to him. And of course, working with the local convention and visitors bureau has helped a lot, and mm-hmm. and what sort of deal he gets to offer. But I think Sacramento put together a very good package when we started to put it together. And of course, I knew absolutely nothing about bringing a bike show and what it entailed. But it's been really a great learning curve, and it's given me a chance to meet lots of great people here in the city that do this sort of thing for a living.
Speaking with Rick Houston about the Handmade Bike Festival, which takes place this Friday through Sunday at the Sacramento Community Center Theater, and also here's Steve Rex, who actually does make handmade cycles. When people go to the festival this weekend, what will they see?
Well, the first show that I went to was last year in Austin, and it's amazing that when you enter into the convention center and you walk through those doors for the first time, it's going to be like Disneyland. Yeah, you're going to see many, many custom bicycles of all sorts of colors and designs, and the quality is incredible. And I think it's amazing for people to know that these are actually the finest bicycles being made in the world, mm-hmm. which is always wonderful to know that we have one person here in town that does that sort of thing. And Steve has been just terrifically helpful in kind of walking me through the process to see what builders really need and how they do what they do. So,
and we should say we have more than one, I think. There are other people who build sort of stretch cruiser bikes, but you build mostly sort of road bikes, like what people think of as racing bikes.
Yeah,
right?
Mostly traditional style bikes. They're road bikes, tandems, track bikes, mountain bikes, cyclocross bikes. Mm-hmm. But, they're not low riders or...
Right.
BMX bikes or
cruisers, which we do have people in town making. Rick, at the festival, will it be all road bikes?
No. If I'm imagining it's going to be very similar to what was available in Austin, and you saw a little bit of everything. You saw the ultra expensive racers, the commuter bikes, the mountain bikes. I mean, just everything is there because people want to demonstrate their techniques. And what they can and cannot produce, and you're going to see some amazing designs that just so people can kind of show off their skills.
And where are these people coming from?
All over the world. I mean, we're going to have builders from Italy, and I believe there's going to be some folks here from Japan, and all over the United States.
Yeah, 18 countries.
Wow,
are represented. Besides the U.S.
And as a bike maker, Steve Rex, what do you look for when you go to something like this? This must be like, talk about, you said Disneyland, Rick.
I think
for the average person, maybe not Disneyland. For Steve, probably Disneyland, right?
Yeah, the level of craftsmanship in the industry has come up so far in the last few years. And I think it's largely the result of this show and the internet, really. People can make incredible things, and the pictures are available throughout the world, and they can really show their craftsmanship. And a lot of people have stepped up and really raised the level of the game.
Great. Well, we'll have a link to the Handmade Bike Fest site on our page, capradio.org/insight. And Steve Rex, Rick Houston, thanks so much for coming in, and good luck with the festival this weekend.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. It's great.
The Community Center again this weekend, Friday through Sunday. And that's Insight for today. Our assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Today's associate producer was Sosa Morar. Our technical director is Mark Jones, and Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. I'm David Watts Barton. Thanks for joining us.